This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. One of the most well-known left intellectual scholars and authors, Noam Chomsky, in a new book, Chomsky for Activists, delves into his formative years as a young Jewish American youth opposing the march of fascism in Europe, his friendship with historian Howard Zinn, his reflections on Zionism and Palestine, and more. Now in his 90s, Chomsky remains one of the most cited living scholars in modern history, and yet is not as well known in the United States as he is outside its borders. Professor Chomsky is currently a laureate professor of linguistics and the Agnes Nelms Hoary Chair in Linguistics at the University of Arizona. Previously, he was professor emeritus at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, where he worked for decades. He's the author of countless books on politics, U.S. foreign policy, and more. His books include Manufacturing Consent with Ed Herman, Hegemony or Survival, Requiem for the American Dream, Understanding Power, and more. He now joins me to discuss his latest book with Charles Derber, Suren Mudaliar, and Paul Shannon, called simply Chomsky for Activists. Welcome to the program, Professor Chomsky.
Pleased to be with you.
So the book, Chomsky for Activists, delves into many of your early years, the activism that you engaged in, some aspects of which people may not be as familiar with. And I'm wondering if you can put our current organizing into historical perspectives. You spent many of your early years moved to action around the rise of fascism in Europe. Today, we're seeing a resurgence in Europe and in the US of fascist elements. But it's a very different context, right, in terms of the digital information age, where we can certainly share information faster than ever. But it's also a problem that fascist ideas appear to spread more efficiently on the internet. Are there similarities and differences between your youth and today in the battle against fascism?
There are other means, but I think the basic issues and problems remain the same. First of all, face-to-face communication is much more effective than sending messages over the internet. A lot of organizational activities do take place through social media and the internet. That can certainly expedite some things, also has negative consequences, tends to make interconnections more shallow and superficial, drives people into bubbles. We know all about that. But basically, the same questions arise. Can you reach people with the understanding that they are able to take their affairs into their own hands if they make the effort, if they break through the shackles of propaganda, thought control, which are all over, organize, set their goals, feasible goals, move towards them step by step? It's always the same, no matter what techniques you're using.
You discuss how, as a youth, you traveled a lot to Israel and Palestine as a young activist. The issue of organizing around Palestine has been, unfortunately, reduced to one around anti-Semitism, especially on U.S. campuses. There's lots of issues around free speech that are raised to it. And for there was a time when there was this legitimate critique of Israeli apartheid that appeared to be taking hold in the U.S. But today we have very effectively, unfortunately, seen pro-Palestinian voices being shut out using accusations of anti-Semitism. It's been over half a century. Do you have any hope that in your lifetime, Israel will be held to account, Palestinians will see justice and a homeland? This is an issue that you followed from a young age until now.
I followed it from a very large part of my life since childhood. I don't want to go through the whole history, but just take the last 60 years. Until the 1967 war, Israel was not a big issue in Israel and Palestine were not a big issue in U.S. public affairs. So the journals that are now avid extremist Zionist, like Commentary, were basically non-Zionist, so much so that the Zionist organization even set up its own counter publications to commentary midstream to try to introduce some pro-Israeli voice into the discussion. But it basically wasn't much of an issue. Nor, incidentally, was the Holocaust. So you didn't have Holocaust museums all over the country, Holocaust courses in the schools and so on. It was kind of a low-keyed issue. Some people were interested, some not. 1967 changed all of that radically. Also radically changed US relations with Israel. Before that, they were cordial, but not radically different from others. After 67 became totally different from any others. US, it's worth remembering that Israel's victory in 1967 was a major gift to the United States. There was a conflict in the Arab world, not just simmering, actually reaching the level of war between radical Islamism, which was centered in Saudi Arabia, main US ally, and secular nationalism, centered in Nasser's Egypt, which the US was strongly opposed to. The British, when they had run the place, had pretty consistently supported radical Islam against secular nationalism, which they regarded as a much greater threat. The US pretty much took that over with some variations. There was actually a war going on between Saudi Arabia and Egypt at the time. Israel intervened, pretty much smashed secular nationalism. Tremendous gift to Saudi Arabia and to its US backers. And that shifted the geopolitical structure of the region. US power came to be based on essentially three pillars. Saudi Arabia, long-standing ally since its founding because of its enormous oil supplies. After 67, Israel became a part. And the third part was Iran, which of course was then under the Shah, US ally. You know, US had installed the Shah in 1953, overthrowing the parliamentary regime. Technically, these countries were all at war with each other, but in fact, they had very close relationships. And the US aid Israel enormously increased at this point, but the culture changed. It became radically pro-Israel. In the intellectual world, world of publication and so on, people who had been non-Zionist before became avid Zionists, journals did. It became almost impossible to talk about Palestinian concerns and issues. I don't want to go through my own experience. There weren't very many people talking about this, but talks were canceled, meetings were broken up. It was necessary to have police protection on campus. Even my own campus, police insisted on accompanying me back to my car after talks. It was very, very hard to speak about it. That change began to change a little bit with Israel's invasion of Lebanon in 1982, but the major change was Israel's violent attacks on Gaza in this millennium mainly, which made a radical shift. Right. Then it suddenly became possible to talk about the issue.
Today, but we have these elected officials like Ilhan Omar and Rashida Tlaib, who are much more open to discussing the issue of Palestinian rights in the sphere where policy is made. And yet, of course, there's a lot of pressure to never criticize Israel, even when women like Tlaib and Omar, who are elected officials, do it. Do you see that as an opening and a potential breakthrough in the United States?
Well, there have been, I should mention, just to finish up what I was saying, that though there was virtually no support for Palestinians, and it was almost impossible to talk about the issue, nevertheless, the Zionist movement was concerned. There's a very related to this matter of anti-Semitism that you brought up. There was a very important article which people should look at in, I think it was 1972, by Abba Eban, the foreign minister of Israel, regarded as a leading dove, a highly respected statesman, partly because he had a good Oxford accent, which gave him a little bit of extra veneer. He wrote an article in the Congress Weekly, the Journal of the American Jewish Congress, that was the more liberal Zionist group. It was a very important article. And it was a message to American Jews. And he said, your task is to show that there's no difference between anti-Zionism and anti-Semitism. And by anti-Zionism, he didn't mean anti-Zionism. He meant criticism of his government, criticism of the government of Israel. If you criticized its policies, you were an anti-Semite. And American Jews have to understand that. That leads right to the kinds of things that you were talking about. At that time, he couldn't mention too many people because there were very few critics of Israel. But he said, for non-Jews, if they're critical of, if they're what he called anti-Zionist, that's anti-Semitism. And then I said, there's a few Jews who are critical, what he called anti-Zionist. And he mentioned two. I was one, the other was I.F. Stone. I.F. Stone was an active Zionist, but critical of Israel. I was critical of Israel, took no general stand on Zionism. He said, these people are guilty of a neurotic self-hatred. They have a guilt complex. So we can kind of dismiss them. So that takes care of everybody. If they're Jews, it's a neurotic self-hatred. If it's non-Jews, they're anti-Semites. And that's the position pretty much ever since. As criticism of Israel developed and became broader, became a major issue on campus and elsewhere, then the claim of anti-Semitism rises to the fore. That's the weapon of self-defense. Then we get into the kind of situation you described before. Right now, it's what's happening is quite interesting. If you look at, the main support for Israel in the United States, it used to be American liberalism. Israel was the darling of democratic liberals, young Jews as well. That's changed substantially. By now, among people who identify themselves as liberals, actually more are supportive of Palestinian rights than of Israel. You can also see it in the major journals. So take, say, the New York Review of Books, the leading sort of liberal intellectual journal. For years, they would not touch the issue. Actually, I was writing for them back in the late 60s and early 70s. They'd publish anything I wrote, but nothing that had a word to say about Israel. That went into the 1980s. It was a topic you simply couldn't touch. That's changed substantially. And take a look at their current issue. There's a very important article by Nathan Thrall from the International Crisis Group, highly expert, respected commentator on Middle East affairs. It's a very sharp criticism of Israeli practices. It simply says we have to recognize that Israel has become an apartheid state, and it goes through the details. You couldn't say anything remotely like that 10 or 15 years ago. You would have been shot, you know. Now it's in the main Journal of American Liberalism. The support for Israel in the United States has shifted substantially. It's now a Republican issue, not a Democratic issue, and anything like what it was before. And it's the far right. It's Christian evangelicals, ultranationalists, military security industry and supporters and so on. That's a major shift. and it would offer new opportunities for activists. But it does bring up the defense mechanisms that you mentioned. You're all anti-Semites.
Right.
So if you criticize Israel, you're an anti-Semite. This
right.
even more extreme in many ways in England, where there's a movement even by the government to and actions to try to silence, to insist on adherence to the what's called the IHRA definition of anti-Semitism, which basically rules out critical comments on Israel. It's imposed. Student groups are banned if they don't adhere to it and so on. All of this, I think, is a sign of desperation. It's become very hard to defend Israeli practices on the basis of the facts. So therefore, the defense mechanisms are moving to another terrain. You're an anti-Semite, then we start debating anti-Semitism. Meanwhile, forgetting the issue of the plight of Palestinians. But I think there are real opportunities now that didn't exist before. You don't have to have police protection now when you're right. giving a talk, saying a few critical words about Israel and saying that Palestinians have rights too. That's a big difference.
Unfortunately, of course, a lot of people who do speak about Palestine are still censored on, say, social media platforms. And I want to transition to a discussion around free speech. This has been an important issue for you. You've long been somewhat of an absolutist on free speech, refusing to accept any restrictions on even hate speech and in favor of more speech. But today we have the social media platform algorithms that build their business models on the most extremist and sensationalist content rising to the top because it helps make them more money and privileging hate speech over the counter speech to it. So I'm wondering if it still works to say that more speech is important. For example, when Twitter banned Donald Trump, there was a 73% decline in misinformation on social media. And of course, we can't trust Jack Dorsey and Mark Zuckerberg of Twitter and Facebook to be the arbiters of free speech, as we know how they've silenced, you know, Palestinian rights activists. But they do need to be limits, don't they? I mean, we don't have the right to scream fire in a crowded theater. Anti-vaxxers shouldn't be spreading misinformation, say, about vaccines today while there's a race between vaccines and viruses. So how do we deal with the issue of free speech in this landscape of social media where the craziest, the most hateful content rises to the top by design?
Well, first of all, do you really want big tech, Twitter, Google, others, to decide what voices can be heard and what voices can't be heard? I don't want to give them that power. I don't think they should have it. The problem you mentioned does exist. They have, so Facebook has algorithms designed, which in fact have the effect of exaggerating the role and leading people towards the more sensationalist, much of it hate speech, propaganda. Well, they shouldn't have the right to decide on those algorithms. In fact, we should ask whether the question of these new information media have a new are part of a raise serious questions about their existence and practices. Quite apart from this, they are not private media; they're privately owned, but they're information platforms which make use of public airwaves and other basically public gifts. So they're not quite private institutions. Now, we do allow totally private institutions to carry out total censorship. So if the New York Times decides that certain views can't be expressed, they're banned. Nobody has a word to say about it. If a publisher, I'll take a real case, happens to be my own. If a multinational corporation decides to put a publisher out of business, destroying all their stock to prevent them from distributing a book, happens to be one of mine in this case, not a violation of free speech. multinational corporations are allowed to do what they want. With regard to media, like say the press and television, there were at one point limited requirements that there be fair access to various points of view. They were eliminated in the Reagan administration. Could be reinstituted, maybe good idea, maybe not. But these institutions are subject to law. So if the New York Times or CBS publishes something libelous, they are subject to libel suits. That's the famous provision 203 of the Communications Act, which is up for discussion now. Twitter and Google are not. They say, we're not responsible for what anybody puts up here. Well, that question can be raised. Should they be subjected to the same constraints as public media? My own feeling, frankly, is that it's not only wrong in principle, but even tactically wrong to find ways to censor speech you don't like. It doesn't have the effect of eliminating the ideas and their spread. In fact, it often intensifies them because they then feel, the people feel aggrieved, we're being shut up, we have to become more extreme, more violent. In fact, we even see it right now. Like Trump's popularity among his base is actually increasing, and they're taking more extreme positions now that they feel that they're under attack. They're, whatever their concerns and claims are, aren't being answered, they're just under attack. So tactically, it's rather dubious. In principle, I think it's wrong. With Trump on Twitter, take that particular case. I think a case could be made that in the last few days of his term in office, it made some sense to prevent him from having access to these media. He was openly inciting violence and insurrection. For a few days, that could be stopped. I think the permanent silence is just a mistake. It may be unpleasant to live with, but the answer to speech you hate is educational efforts to overcome the to look into the basis for it, deal with the roots, and respond to the arguments. There's no other way.
I want to transition next to sort of staying on the issue of disinformation. You recently signed on to a letter initiated by Stephen Shalom called Erasing People Through Disinformation, Syria and the Anti-Imperialism of Fools. The letter discusses the, quote, emergence of pro-Assad allegiances in the name of anti-imperialism amongst some who otherwise generally identify as progressive or left, and the consequent spread of manipulative disinformation that routinely deflects attention away from the well-documented abuses of Assad and his allies, end of quote. And it's a pretty lengthy letter, but a number of prominent Syrian intellectuals signed the letter alongside you. And I'm wondering, who are these leftists in your mind that have emerged as de facto Assad apologists, and why is it important to call them out?
On Syria, we should tell the truth. Part of the truth is that Assad is a major mass murderer, one of the main criminals on the international scene. Nothing you can say about him. Another part of the truth is that the United States and its allies back in 2011, 2012, the time of the days of the Arab Spring, when Assad reacted to democracy demonstrations by moderate reformists with extreme violence, the US and its allies intervened to try to overthrow him. They ended up, it was pretty clear that this was going to lead to more violence, more war. Pretty soon the US and its allies were supporting Assad had succeeded pretty much in crushing the democratic opposition. They either were destroyed or fled. Met many of them, and I personally met many of them in Lebanon. Just had to flee. The United States and its allies were basically supporting what pretty soon became jihadi forces. It was clear that as the CIA continued to provide more advanced weapons, that sooner or later the Russians would come in. That did happen in 2015, exactly as predicted. The US, of course, had to back off at that time. Some support for the jihadis, but it was not going to get into a nuclear war with Russia. After that, atrocities simply continued, blew out of sight. The United States has now imposed extremely harsh sanctions, which are destroying the civilian population. That's what sanctions do. They don't hit the leadership. And Syria is being devastated in part by Assad's atrocities, part by US sanctions, part by the remaining jihadi violence. I should think people should be telling the truth about all of this, not apologizing for Assad, not suppressing the grotesque US role. And that was the point of the petition, of that statement.
Finally, coming back to the United States, I'm wondering what your assessment is of Joe Biden's term so far. I remember being deeply disappointed when Biden was the nominee last year for the Democratic Party, you know, just sort of seeing him as a continuation of President Obama. But so far, his stated politics are much more transformational than Obama's. Is that because he's operating in a space that the left has created, where there's a greater demand for progressive politics, more broadly speaking, in the United States today than when Obama was president? How much do we give credit to Biden versus the movement?
Actually, we have to distinguish domestic and foreign policy. So let's talk about domestic policy. On that, I give credit to Biden for being open to pressure from the activist base of the Democratic Party. It's partly the, largely in fact, the Sanders movement, which was extremely successful, created an umbrella under which many other activist groups have been able to move forward. Tremendous success of activism over the past few years, everything from Sunrise Movement to pro-labor groups, pro-immigrant groups and others, which has moved the Democratic Party platform towards a position which the Democratic National Committee, the Clintonite neoliberals, don't like at all, but it's moved it far more towards a progressive direction than anything in recent memory, maybe back to FDR. And this is quite the stimulus bill is a good example. I mean, just take the people appointed. I mean, in the Senate, the head of the Budget Committee, a very powerful committee, is Bernie Sanders. In the Council of Economic Advisors, you now actually have economists who write for radical economics journals, people from EPI, the main pro-labor research institution. What's in the stimulus bill, the $1.9 trillion stimulus bill, something that I wouldn't have expected a couple of months ago. Now, of course, it's temporary, but if it can be made permanent, then it would be, as you say, transformative. There's a wall of opposition to achieve anything at all is extremely difficult. The Republican organization, which you can hardly call a political party any longer, is unanimously dedicated to trying to make the country ungovernable. McConnell's position, he stated it pretty openly when Obama came in, they're doing it now. So 100% opposition, even to things they favor. Stimulus bill is an example. Many Republican representatives, I wouldn't be surprised if most of them support a lot of what's in the stimulus bill. They're perfectly aware that their constituents support it. Nevertheless, 100% vote against it, like the old Communist Party. Orders come from the leadership, 100% obedience, doesn't matter what you think. They have one commitment: make the country ungovernable, make things as bad as possible, blame it on the Democrats. Maybe we can come back into power in 2002 and 2004. There's a kind of split in the Republican Party. There always has been a tension. The people who own the party, and in fact own the country, the donor class, they never liked Trump. They don't like his antics, they don't like his behavior, but they were willing to tolerate him because he was lining their pockets. The entire legislative program under Trump was major gifts to the super rich and the corporate sector. His one main legislative achievement, the tax scam, was a perfect example of this. The deregulation is the same, harms the population, moves towards destroying the planet, but it enriches the ultra rich in the short term. So they were willing to tolerate him. That kind of broke down on January 6th. That was too much. And with surprising unanimity, the titans of big business turned against Trump, told him to get lost. The Chamber of Commerce, CEOs of major corporations, and so on. Well, McConnell and other senators heard the message, began to criticize Trump, ran for the exits. They didn't go too far, because at the exits, they saw the raging mobs that Trump had organized. And that brings up a problem that the Republican Party's been trying to face for 60 years. The party itself, basically in the United States, there's two factions of one party, the business party. The Democrats have, the Republicans have been somewhat more supportive of the wealth and private power than the Democrats have. And Democrats pretty much abandoned the working class in the 1970s. But the Republicans have been the more extreme in this direction. That poses a problem for them. You can't come to the electorate and say, I'm in favor of enriching the very rich and empowering the corporate sector and stabbing you in the back. So please vote for me. That doesn't work. So they've had to shift, and they understand it, to what are called cultural issues. Let's stop talking about the economic problems, about class issues, don't want any of that stuff. Let's talk about going back to Nixon, the Southern strategy. Let's present ourselves as basically the party opposed to rights for Afro-Americans. When you get to Reagan, and it's just open racism, welfare queens, opening his campaign in the place, Philadelphia, Mississippi, the place that's known only for the murder of civil rights workers all the way through. Let's shift on other issues. Abortion's an interesting case. In the 1960s, the Republican leadership was strongly pro-choice. That includes Reagan, George H.W. Bush, all the rest of them. Republican strategist Paul Weyrich, mid-70s, realized that if the Republican Party pretends to be anti-abortion, they'll pick up the big evangelical bloc. It's about 25% of the population, Northern Catholics and so on. They all shifted on a dime. Now one of the banners held high by the Republican Party is anti-abortion. Same on gun rights, same on many other immigrants, many other things. You have to find what are called cultural issues, focus the population, your voting base on those. Maybe they won't notice the fact that you're stabbing them in the back. Trump was a genius at this, very successful. his policies were very harmful to working people, minorities, of course, the poor, middle class, most of the middle class, but he was able to mobilize them, many of them in his support, mostly relatively affluent, petty bourgeois, some others. He was able to mobilize them on cultural issues while harming them brutally in his legislative program. Now it's becoming very serious. The donor class doesn't want to tolerate it anymore. The population, the popular support group are enraged. They're even becoming more opposed to allowing voting rights. That's a big problem for the party. Democratic Party has its own split. The Democratic National Committee, the party management are basically Clintonite, Obama type, Wall Street oriented neoliberals whose preferred constituency is relatively affluent professionals. The party base is becoming different. The activist groups you mentioned have become very effective. Sanders was a major factor in that, but many others too. And therefore you get the kinds of programs that have been partially instituted in the stimulus program. Both parties are facing serious internal problems. Should say that this is happening in Europe too, where the traditional parties are pretty much collapsing. We can trace all of this back to a fundamental problem. The neoliberal attack on the population in the last 40 years began in the late 70s, took off with Reagan, Thatcher, swept over most of the Western world. It's been extremely harmful to the general population. In the United States, where it's been studied carefully, the highly respectable RAND Corporation really recently tried to estimate the transfer of wealth from the working class and the middle class. Their method is the lower 90% of the income scale, the transfer of wealth to them, from them to the very top. And that doesn't mean the top 10%, it means a fraction of 1%. Well, their estimate is about $50 trillion in 40 years. Not small change, and a radical underestimate, because they do not count in the methods that Reagan and his gang introduced to allow further robbery of the public, like tax havens, which is probably another tens of trillions of dollars. In general, massive attack on the general population, super enrichment of a very few, destruction of unions and labor, which is very important. That eliminates the main method by which working people can defend themselves from the attack. This began right away with Reagan and Thatcher. Democrats didn't object. As I say, they abandoned the working class in the by the 70s. Well, under this is, of course, radically undermined the functioning of democracy, concentrate power, concentrate economic power, feeds right away into control of the government. All of this has been a self-escalating crisis. Population suffering from it provides very fertile terrain for demagogues to stand up and say, I'm your savior. And then your problem is, of course, not the rich and powerful. We got to protect them. Your problem is immigrants, African-Americans, welfare queens, Islamic terrorists, anybody else out there. And there's, remember, even the most vulgar propaganda, if it succeeds, has elements of truth to it. You look at Trump's voting base, they are mostly moderately affluent. But they have suffered under the neoliberal era. You take say farmers, individual farmers have been devastated. huge numbers of them have been just thrown out of business as major agribusiness takes over, highly subsidized by the government. Trump was pouring money into it, but not poor farm, not small farmers. Take a trip through rural America where much of the base is. Houses are for sale, businesses are boarded up, maybe the bank is closed, there's probably a couple of churches still around, young people are leaving, there's no jobs, the neoliberal globalization programs intensified by Clinton have been designed to undermine the working class, support rich investors. All of this shows, and it gives you the, and it's combined with the recognition, which is correct, that the traditional America that they loved and wanted is disappearing. Traditional Christian, often evangelical, white supremacist America, where the other folks knew their place and didn't bother us, that's disappearing. You can't, they're not going to change that. That underlies a sense of resentment and anger, which is fortified by the neoliberal assault and leads to the kind of situation we're now seeing with the split in both parties. This is a very, very serious problem for the whole country. How we're going to deal with this is not easy. Similar problems are arising in Europe. If the Bidenite Democratic Party were able to move through on its moderately progressive programs, that could give an answer. It could lead to a major growth period, more egalitarian growth, less subsidy and support for the predatory, destructive sectors of the society, energy industry, financial institutions, and so on. And there are moves in that direction. Janet Yellen, Secretary of Treasury, gave an important speech in which she called for a global minimum corporate tax. That's extremely important. If it can be instituted, it would put an end to the race to the bottom effort of countries trying to attract financial capital and the corporate invest in the corporate bases by providing lower taxes, robbing the general population, robbing them of tens of trillions of dollars, huge amounts, could put a limit and a break on that. Well, these are all steps that can be taken. Financial transaction tax could be instituted, cut back predatory trading methods. Labor can be reconstituted, crucial. Trump administration was bitterly anti-labor. Take a look at the Labor Department under Eugene Scalia, corporate lawyer whose life had been devoted to breaking unions, did everything he could as Trump's labor secretary to undermine labor, following policies, extending policies from before. All of that can be reversed. There are plenty of things that can be done. You could have a period of relatively egalitarian growth, dealing with fundamental problems in the country, like collapsing infrastructure, massive poverty and malnutrition, the scandal, total scandal of healthcare. The United States healthcare system is an international scandal. It's twice the costs of comparable countries, OECD countries, relatively poor outcomes. Major medical journal in the world, the British Lancet, tried to estimate the annual costs, came roughly 70,000 deaths a year, $500 billion of extra expenses, plenty of problems. Anybody who's had to deal with the healthcare system is familiar with the problems. All of this can be eliminated. We can rise to the level of other countries and even go beyond and have a decent healthcare system. public health care system, which everybody gets health care. That's less expensive, much better. You cut off tons of administrative bureaucracy, extra profits for the managers and owners and so on. All of that can be eliminated. Population's pretty much in favor of it. It's never been able to get through because of opposition from the financial sector, from insurance companies, unwillingness of the Democratic Party to really fight for it. That could be changed. You can find cases, take the most important issue there is, destruction of the environment. We don't deal with this, nothing else matters. We have a couple of decades, maybe, to deal with the environmental crisis. Under Trump, government policy was to magnify the crisis. Let's race to the abyss as quickly as possible, maximize the use of fossil fuels, eliminate any regulatory apparatus that deals with them. They knew exactly what they were doing. You can see it from their own documents. Let's maximize short-term profits and destroy the life, the possibility for organized human life on Earth. They get back into office. You're going to see that again, and we're finished, okay? We'll soon reach irreversible tipping points. Now, popular activism from Sunrise Movement and others did push the Biden campaign to adopt a moderately decent, not perfect, but at least moderately decent environmental policy. Democratic National Committee fought it every step of the way, but they did manage to get it through. Can it be implemented? Can it be improved to the point where it actually deals with the problems? That's the problem for activists today.
Right.
Unless we do that, nothing, literally nothing else is going to matter. So that's the top priority. It's got to be done, can be done, it's feasible, it's within the range of economic feasible possibilities. 2 or 3% of gross domestic product would be sufficient to deal with it. Pretty good evidence for that. A lot of different independent analyses come up with pretty much the same conclusion. Feasible, necessary. It's going to be enormous efforts to block it. Follow the news. You probably just noticed that now that oil prices are rising, the fracking industry, which had been dormant for a while, is back in business. They've announced openly, that they are not going to follow the Obama-era regulations rescinded by Trump. They're not going to follow the regulations that prevent them from pouring methane into the atmosphere. Very destructive. Far more destructive in the short term than CO2. There are feasible means to control it. Trump eliminated them, and they're saying straight out, we're not going to observe them. Well, that's the world we're living in, and it has to be changed quickly, and it can be done successfully, can be done with proper transition of oil workers to better jobs and more better communities, better life. All of this is feasible. We know how to do it. It has to be done. Those are tasks for the serious activists, plus ensuring that the support for children in the temporary families with children and dealing with child poverty, it's in the temporary stimulus bill, make that permanent, and many other things, give funding state and localities desperately needed, eliminating the rotting infrastructure system, all desperately needed, all make a better world, more livable world, more equitable world, all possible. But it won't happen by itself. It's going to take the kind of dedicated, engaged activism that led to the moderately progressive Biden program today. And similar problems arise on foreign policy. Haven't right. talked about it.
Right. Yeah, we could, I'm sure, spend a lot more time talking about foreign policy, but we're out of time. I want to thank you so much today for joining us, Noam Chomsky. Really appreciate it, and good luck with the book.
Thank you.
My guest has been Noam Chomsky, Laureate Professor of Linguistics and the Agnes Nelms-Hori Chair in Linguistics at the University of Arizona. Previously, he was Professor Emeritus at MIT, considered the father of modern linguistics. Noam Chomsky is one of the most cited scholars in modern history and the author of countless books on politics and more. We've been discussing his latest book with Charles Durber, Suren Moodliar, and Paul Shannon called Chomsky for Activists. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our newsletter, find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify.